guys, and welcome to episode 200 of the OCDstories.com podcast. Now, firstly, thank you for listening to episode 200. Thank you if you've listened to previous episodes. We also, last night, just broke 2 million downloads, so it's quite timely that it would fall on episode 200. I hope the podcast continues to support and inspire you in your recovery, and I appreciate all the support over the last 4 years. And this episode is with Dr. Stephen Phipson. Now, Steve and I go back to episode 99, so 101 episodes ago is when I first got him on. And we've done a lot of podcasts since, so I'll link to all those in the show notes. So it was wonderful to have him on as the 200th guest, or the 200th episode. And in this, I was going to focus on the last part of ERP, which is response prevention. And we do that in this episode, but it also became more of a general ERP, exposure and response prevention episode, so we also talk about it in its entirety. Stephen gives loads of examples of ERP in practice. He sets up what is ERP, and he goes into a lot of detail and gives a great explanation, talking about understanding response prevention, graded flooding, the goal of ERP, not undoing exposure work by doing compulsions, how to deal with inadvertent spikes, demonstrating irrelevance, and much, much more. So thank you to Stephen for his time across all the episodes we've done. Thank you to you guys for being with me on this journey. And without further ado, here is episode 200.
On today's show, I have Dr. Stephen Phipson. Stephen is a licensed clinical psychologist who specializes in cognitive behavioral therapy for OCD. He co-founded the first support group for OCD sufferers in the New York area in 1987. Stephen is the clinical director at the Center for Cognitive Behavioral Psychotherapy. Welcome back to the show, Steve.
Always good to see you, Stu. Looking forward to this topic. Very excited to talk about what I consider to be the most important aspect of my career.
Absolutely. And we're going to get into that and what it is. Well, I don't think I ever asked you this. So when you first started that support group in 1987, what inspired you to start it, and why start it effectively?
Sort of funny enough, I was in a therapy session with a patient, and she asked me whether I knew of any support groups for people who suffer from OCD. And so I looked into it, did a bunch of research, and found out that at that time, there wasn't any behavioral support groups for OCD sufferers. There were some support groups just for people to kind of get together and share their stories, but there was no formal treatment for sufferers who wanted to combine the support aspect of working with others and also the treatment aspect of being guided by a expert. So after I looked into it and found out that there was not such thing available, my mentor, Dr. Gordon Ball, and I pooled our caseloads together and started the first OCD support group at that time, combining behavior therapy and the support aspect of people being able to talk to each other, share their stories, and really kind of give each other support in the treatment process.
Oh, great. And what was the, because I mean, you know, there's still stigma around mental health now to a point, but I can imagine in the late 80s, it was even more so. And even though the people at the support group were your clients and your colleagues' clients, were they quite open in talking to each other in the support group, or was there still some kind of hesitancy?
Definitely the vast majority of patients really took solace in the confidentiality of that environment. Obviously, we had guidelines for people to not discuss or disclose the names or identity of any of the members. So once in the group, people really opened up in a very, very, I think, uninhibited way. And there was a tremendous energy for the people to be in the same room with others. Most people in that support group, and even to this day when new members join, say this is the first time that they've ever spoken to other persons with OCD in an open and educated kind of a forum. So it's very, very rewarding to see these people giving each other support, guidance, and a lot of comfort in understanding that they're not alone.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, no, thank you for appeasing my curiosity.
Any curiosity you have, I am the appeasemeister.
Excellent. Thank you. So today I wanted to, as you know, get you on to talk about the RP in ERP. And the show, this podcast, has talked about ERP almost every episode. And I think it naturally, whether it's myself or the guest, kind of focuses around the exposure more than the RP. And I wanted to, I guess, give some special time to that second part of ERP. But before we get into that, what is ERP?
ERP, spelled out, is exposure with response or ritual prevention. Some people use one, some people use the other. The idea is that we are trying to demonstrate to a malfunctioning brain that the themes that the brain has linked with the malfunctioning emotional energy of anxiety, guilt, anger, depression, and sometimes disgust, that these malfunctioning signals are irrelevant to the sufferer. And that's a huge part of understanding the essential features of what ERP is going to involve, because we can't talk to this part of the brain. The part of the brain that's malfunctioning is called the amygdala. It's located in the very basic reptilian portion of the brain. And it has no language capability. So I can't say to a patient, silly you, you cannot catch AIDS from a doorknob. I could try, but it would have no impact on the amygdala's malfunctioning. And so many, many patients go to therapists who believe that these patients are suffering from information deficiency. And so a lot of therapists spend a lot of wasted time and effort discussing the themes, the irrationality of the themes with the patient, as if the patient is somewhat handicapped in their rational thinking. And vast majority, if not entirety, of OCD sufferers do not have a dysfunction of rational thinking. They have a dysfunction of emotional malfunctioning. And so you have these very rational, very intelligent people who are extraordinarily manipulated by the most absurd, inane topics that their brain can come up with, because the emotional signal that's malfunctioning is so authentically powerful and overwhelming that it manipulates the sufferer to abide by our most basic instinct for survival, to engage in escape responses that ultimately demonstrate to the malfunctioning machine brain that the signal was legitimate, that these topics might have some legitimacy to them, some reality to them, rational nature to them. And so it creates, by people giving into the malfunctioning signal, it creates this cycle of reinforcement to the brain's malfunctioning amygdala that says, yes, these warnings are relevant to me. So ERP is the formal aggressive disciplined process where the patient engages in, as you've discussed, these exposure exercises in a way that doesn't undo the exposure and allows the brain, through repeated exposure exercises without the escape part, that the brain ultimately sees that because the gatekeeper, the person who the decision maker in our brain, you and me, the persons that are ultimately responsible for our final perspective and the final choices that we make, that when the gatekeeper chooses repeatedly to show the malfunctioning brain that its signals are irrelevant, the brain behaves itself in a very predictable way by gradually, engaging in less and less malfunctioning, less and less distress signals that are put out in association with these topics. Did that answer your question?
I was going to say, yeah, much more detailed than I thought, but that's great.
I hope you don't edit too much of that out.
That's a great explanation. So I think also the reason why the E gets talked about a lot, so the exposure, is because in business, this term, you sell the sizzle and not the bacon. You know,
you sell the what?
You sell the sizzle.
The sizzle.
Yeah. And not the
you
bacon.
You sell the sizzle. And not, I've never heard, you know, when you Brits introduce me to these sayings of yours across that pond,
yeah,
I can often get bewildered. And this one has definitely bewildered me.
Well, yeah. So
sell the sizzle.
So you're selling the glitz and the glam of the sounds of cooking. You don't say, hey, I've got this bit of bacon, will you buy it? You say, you bring it to life through the, you know. Anyway, so exposure is that. It's this scary thing of, oh, here's my hierarchy and I have to do this, I have to face this fear and I have to do this thing. And it's the sizzle kind of thing. And not to downplay the exposure part, but the RP to me gets hidden or neglected sometimes because it is, it's the bacon, it's the bit that isn't flashy.
I've written down some notes, and one of the things I wanted to right off the bat make perfectly clear is one of, I think, the most common misnomers in the world of ERP. A lot of times a patient will engage in an exposure exercise and report afterward that they didn't feel anxious. And they get highly distressed because they say, how can I get better if I don't get anxious? Or why, when my brain introduces me to these warnings, does it accompany the warnings with distress? But when I voluntarily bring on the exposure, the brain does not respond with anxiety. Mm-hmm. And patients, you know, believe, and many patients are told, that you know, you need to have the exposure evoke an anxiety response so that habituation takes place. And habituation means that when we show the brain repeatedly that we're not going to run from its danger signals, the brain says, aha, there must not really be a problem here. Therefore, the brain gradually, as I said before, slowly discontinues its malfunctioning and sending the alarm signal. The important thing about ERP is that the exposure be a replication of what the brain's warning signal is or the brain's warning topic. So if I were to have a patient look at a picture, let's say this patient has pedophile spiking, and they looked at a picture of some little girl from, what's that show, Toddlers and Tiaras. Have you heard of that show?
I've heard of it, yeah.
I'm sorry to hear that. It's a horrible show.
Never seen it.
Anyway, it's about these moms that exploit their pretty little girls. And so I might drag up a picture of one of these six-year-olds dressed like a, let's say, provocative little girl. And the patient might look at that picture, have a sense of the girl's prettiness, even though she's 6 years old, and that might potentially trigger an anxiety response because the person's theme is, oh, wow, maybe I'm attracted to children, and that would be a really horrible thing. Mm-hmm. But if a patient aggressively takes out a picture of these six-year-old pretty girls and doesn't get anxious, they're still doing very good aggressive work because they're showing their brain over and over again, hey, brain, whether you bring on the anxiety or not, I'm willing to take it on. I'm willing to demonstrate it's not going to have any relevant impact on the choices that I make. And that disposition is really the heart of creating the healing response, the recovery response within the brain's malfunctioning signal.
Yeah, so it doesn't necessarily matter if the anxiety is there or not. It's the behavior after is the important thing.
Well, it's the idea that the patient has conjured up a replication of the brain's a warning signal. So if a patient had their brain might say, spontaneously, you hate God, or you don't believe in God. Let's say the brain says to the person, you don't believe in God. And that would be really, really bad to some persons who are religious. And so they feel anxious because the brain has brought up that signal. Their amygdala is pairing with the cognition of not believing in God, and they feel very anxious. But then when they turn that thought into a voluntary exposure exercise and they say, hey, I don't believe in God, they might then not experience the emotional distress because the brain sees that the person is voluntarily bringing it on. And the brain is sort of a bit confused by that. I was analogize this part of treatment like the effect of when we try to tickle ourselves. Like if someone else tickles us, we might laugh hysterically. We might, kind of wriggle all over the floor. But if we try to tickle ourselves, all of a sudden it's not funny. And so doing voluntary exposure exercises can be very much akin to that. Occasionally, sometimes, the majority of the times, doing an exposure exercise will evoke the predicted emotional response. But for those occasions when it doesn't, it's really important that the patient not get distressed as if they're not going to be able to get better.
No, I think that's a good point. So response prevention or ritual prevention, whichever phrase we want to use, I guess to illustrate it and bring it to life, what does that look like? I think most of my listeners will understand the I'm afraid of contamination, so therefore I touch the bin. You know, or maybe then I lick my hand or whatever it is, or touch my hair after I've touched the bin. But what am I doing after that, or not doing, I should say?
Great, great question. So one of the unique things that we do at the center in regard to working with contamination OC, we do a procedure that's referred to as graded flooding. Now, flooding scares the bejeebers out of most patients because flooding entails going to a 10 within 8 hours and making that 10 exist everywhere in their life. So that can be overwhelming to a lot of people. It can also produce a very profound positive effect, but many people are intimidated by the idea of going from 0 to 10 in that kind of a short period of time. So what we do is we do a graded flooding. What that means is, Let's say when you talk about your bin, or is what we Yanks refer to as a garbage can. trash can, garbage can, sure. Now, for most contamination spikers, that's probably going to be around a 5. So generally, I might have a patient start with, let's say, just a public doorknob, which might be for them, let's say a 2. And what I would have that patient do is maybe take a paper towel and rub a public doorknob with the paper towel. And then that paper towel has now become the embodiment of the germs, let's say, or the dirt, let's say, from that public paper, that public doorknob. And now the patient will take that paper towel home with them and literally touch every item in their house that exist at a 2 or below a 2, not a 3. So they might touch things like their pillows, their towels, their toilet paper, their toothbrush, their silverware, every aspect of their life that they consider to be clean and pure. They're now going to imbue with the contamination of that paper towel. And the great thing is when a patient does this and spreads it everywhere in their universe and carries it with them, and after every wash for any reason, they immediately take out the paper towel again, spread it on their hands, spread it on their body, so that they never again are below a 2. The beauty of that is literally within 2 to 3 days, no matter what they've touched, it will be a 0. And it's such a robust, powerful mechanism. So you asked a great question, though. So let's say, you know, our friend John touches the paper towel to the doorknob, spreads it around everywhere. John is going to look at his brain, and John's going to say to his brain, okay, I'm touching it everywhere. I've got the germs from the doorknob. Hey, brain, bring on the anxiety if you need to. Bring on the reminder. I might get sick. My family might get sick. I'm going to accept the backlash of this exposure. I'm going to allow my brain to send the signal back saying, aha, boy, you're screwing up. You're bringing evil into your life. You're bringing dirt and germs into your life. You're risking sickness. And for the person to say, yes, I acknowledge that risk. I'm going to welcome the possibility that I'm going to get sick. And one of the important and very, very critical aspects about EXRP, and this is so widely misunderstood, people think, oh, we're teaching patients to see that you can't get sick from the doorknob. And that's totally not what the real goal of ERP is. The goal is not that we don't, that these risks or these threats aren't real or legitimate. What we're showing the brain is the willingness to embrace the risk, to allow for the brain to send the signal and to demonstrate the irrelevance of that signal. So the patient, sort of most patients already have an awareness that these ideas and associations are pretty irrelevant. Many patients will say, no, they're different. Many patients will say, no, I believe that my spike theme, that my intrusive thought theme is legitimate. But what they're really saying is that it feels so real. Because when the amygdala malfunctions and it sends that you're about to die signal or your life is in danger signal, it's totally authentic. That amygdala malfunctioning, it's not like it says, hey, just kidding. It's just like that you're in a dark room and a poisonous snake, you know, is running around and you might be bitten and killed at any moment. There's nothing there's nothing phony about it. There's nothing insincere about it. It's thoroughly the same emotional signal that anyone would have faced with a life-threatening situation. And so the legitimacy of that emotional signal and the intensity of it creates these illusions for people to say things like, oh, I feel like my spike theme is legitimate. And I hear that all the time. That's why in my choice article, one of my infamous lines is, I don't really care how you feel, because those feelings are being generated by a broken part of the brain. And therefore, to place an emphasis on them is just a disservice to the recovery process.
Okay.
So I hope I answered the question in terms of, after we do the exposure, what does that response prevention part entail? So it entails, A, easily not undoing what we've exposed ourselves to. So to say, I don't believe in God, to then not say, just kidding, and I still hope I'm going to go to heaven. So you got the exposure. But immediately, if you do an undoing response, then there's no habituation that kind of sinks in. And once again, the habituation is when we repeatedly expose ourselves to the thing that the brain tells us that is threatening or a problem. By not undoing it, the brain naturally shuts off its reactivity to that topic and signal.
Yeah. Okay. Now that makes sense. And response and ritual prevention. So response and ritual are interchangeable words. Ritual arguably aligns more with OCD because ritual is another word for compulsion, and it's effectively compulsion prevention. Which makes me wonder why it was never called ECP. But maybe we can start that trend. So yeah, I guess, are there any more examples you can give of any of your clients that you do the various exposures with them, but then how they either resisted a compulsion or reduced it, or yeah, just kind of didn't undo the work that they did by facing that fear?
Well, one of the ways in which I innovated treatment for persons that don't have observable rituals is I developed a exposure technique that I refer to as index card therapy. You guys, I think, call it palm card. You know, these little cardboard pieces of paper, card, you know. And so I have patients write their spike theme. So that might look like, let's say someone had HOCD or fear of being homosexual. So maybe they're crossing the street and they pass someone of the same gender. And let's say their groin gives them a little bit of a tingle response. And they're like, their spike is, oh my God, you're actually getting a physical sensation in your groin. What more evidence could you have that suggests that you're sexually attracted to the person of the same sex? This must mean you're gay. And so what I have patients do is I say to them, okay, so in this event, you've crossed paths with this person of the same gender, your brain sets off this reaction, and you're now, let's say, feeling a level 6 anxiety. So I have them say to the brain, okay, brain, I've got a blank index card waiting for you. And if you're around in 30 minutes, if you can stick around for 30 minutes and still be present and still hold an energy of distress, I'm going to take this thought and write it exactly on the index card as the brain has presented it. I'm going to then write the date and I'm going to write the intensity of the spike, which was a 6. And then I'm going to indicate whether I'm doing any ritualizing around it. Obviously, the goal is to have that second number be a 0. But even if it was just like a 1 that says, oh, I read that the groinal response is part of OCD, therefore I might not be gay. So that little undoing might just be like a level 1 in terms of that, as opposed to running to the emergency room and saying, can I get a blood test to see if I'm gay or not? You know, that might be a little bit more intrusive. So the second number is really measured by the amount of life-altering ritualization that's taking place. And so one thing I just remembered is, as much as I'm giving, you know, a lot of information about the therapy, and a lot of my articles talk a lot about the therapy, I just want to say that this is not something you sort of do at home without kind of expert guidance, because there's a lot of nuances to the way the therapy works, shall I say, the way the therapy unfolds, that really require the expertise of someone to be able to kind of understand and disseminate this information in a way so that patients are not confused or engage in. Sometimes patients are so desperate to recover that they go further down the road than they're ready for, and things kind of blow up on them and they're like, oh my God, you know, I'm never going to get better. So I really do want to encourage that this information is really to make sure that you understand the nature of what is being done in therapy, to make sure that you're seeing a therapist that understands these nuances, but really to work in a partnership, you know, toward a recovery process.
Yeah. Cool. No, absolutely.
By the way, did that answer your question? Because, you know, I'm a nut about answering questions still.
Yeah.
I go off in these tangents and I'm like, hold it a second. Did I completely answer what Stu was asking in the first place?
Yeah, no, I think you did. I like the index card idea. I think that's clever. And you're alluding to there are people who the term's coined puro, right? So pure obsessional. Yeah. There's no physical compulsions, but there are mental compulsions and mental rituals.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. And when you're setting up, so when with a client or patient and you're talking about ERP, how do you set up the response prevention part? So you're kind of saying we're going to face your fears, whether that's a hierarchy or you're kind of just going to pick and choose exposures, which seems to be the trend now, less of a hierarchy. And then how do you then set up the, and then once we do the exposures, how do you then talk about the ritual prevention?
So I often have patients look at their emotional distress signal and sort of analyze the different systems that are sending distress signals. I'll have a patient first look at, let's say their chest, a very common anxiety response, their chest might feel tight. I have a patient just describe, does it feel like someone's grabbing your chest? Does it feel like your muscles are, kind of constricting? And I'll have them describe in objective details the physical manifestations of the anxiety. And then I'll have them rate the intensity of that. So our friend John, he put his hands on the doorknob, has got that paper towel. He's spreading it on his silverware, knowing that his family's going to touch it. He's going to be eating from it later. And let's say John is at a level 2 again. And so he's got this level 2 tension in his chest. And I'll ask John, is that manageable? Can you put up with that level 2, let's say, for the next 30 minutes? Is it okay if it's there or not there, that you don't have to take a benzo? So I'll have him look at his resilience, his willingness to put up with and bring with him the signal. So John might also have a little bit of sweaty palms, and they may be at a level 3. When I'm with a patient, I'll often say, oh, you've got sweaty palms, let me feel. Most of the time, patients don't have anywhere near what I consider to be sweaty palms. I'm always like, this is really a low-key sweaty palm day. I want to be more impressed than this. But to them, they're having little sweaty palm, reactions. And it just kind of goes to show how hypersensitive and hypervigilant many patients are in terms of their body sending these signals that they might look at as not supposed to be there. Like patients want to live in this world of total tranquility. And I don't think that's common to humans in any way, but a lot of people are very desperate to kind of get back to not aware of any signals. So John's got the sweaty palms level 3. And so I'll have him kind of describe his tolerance to those sweaty palms, his willingness to kind of take that awareness with him. And in doing this, patients develop a greater degree of objectivity to observing these signals rather than just seeing them as, oh, they're here, they shouldn't be here, what can I do to get rid of them? As opposed to, they're here, they're manageable, I've seen them before, I've survived, I don't need to really act in a desperate way to find relief.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. No, cool. Thank you. So next question is, do you ever do response prevention without, for example, take contamination again, there's a good chance New York, for example, where you are, is a big city, or London where I am. Both those cities can get pretty grimy and dirty at times, especially if you get on the subway or London Underground. So someone with contamination is bound to be triggered a lot in these cities. Do you ever say, look, we're not going to do any hierarchy exposures, just over the next week, whenever you feel triggered, try and, instead of washing your hands 5 times, do it 3 times? Or, is there anything like
that? No, I wouldn't tend to do that. I do believe in the effectiveness of a hierarchy.
Yeah.
So, I generally really encourage the structure of doing EXRP rather than the lack of structure of just kind of saying, if you come across a distress signal, maybe try not to kind of give in to that.
Okay, cool. Now that makes sense. And yeah, the structure of the hierarchy kind of gives you and the client that focus, and you're on the attack, so to speak, or on the offense.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, exactly. I'm just trying to think, it's funny because the EXRP, I use that in conjunction. There are two types of recovery opportunities, what I call an inadvertent spike and then a purposeful spike. So EXRP involves the generation of these voluntary repeated exposures. But the brain isn't going to cooperate with just waiting for us to initiate an exposure. And the brain obviously sends these spikes, these intrusive thoughts spontaneously. And so, you know, part of the recovery process is how do you deal with the inadvertent spikes? Because they're the ones that usually arrive at not very convenient times, present the greatest degree of anxiety, much more so than the voluntary exposures. And so a bunch of techniques that I have involve, number one, I refer to it as turning up the volume, which involves, so the spike says, hey, driving to work, you felt a bump that might have been a child under your tire. Turn the car around and make sure there's not a dead body on the road because of your negligent driving. And rather than giving into that spike, the patient might say, yeah, brain, maybe it was a child. Maybe I mowed down his entire family, actually. Maybe it just wasn't one little kid. Maybe it was the entire family. I'm willing to kind of take this uncertainty with me. And that response is a very powerful way to say to the brain, you can deliver a level 4 challenge, and I can choose to take it up to a level 6. Very, very powerful. Also, in managing inadvertent spikes, humor can be a really, really large component in that management system. To say to the brain, maybe I am going to stab my wife tonight in my sleep. Well, maybe I should boil some rice so I can make some sushi out of her and, not have it be a waste after all. To be able to show the brain that you're not going to be fragile about its signals. One method that Edna Foa, and obviously that name rings a bell for everyone who knows anything about OCD, I think she developed a method in terms of people actually singing their spike theme, making up a song about their spike theme. And I occasionally have done that, and I find it to also be very, very powerful, very compelling to the brain to say, all of these techniques are designed to convey irrelevance. And that one word is the single most powerful part of the recovery process, demonstrating irrelevance to the brain signals. That's what produces the two mechanisms of recovery biochemically. And those two mechanisms are, once again, habituation. And the other mechanism is extinction. Habituation comes about when we voluntarily choose to expose ourselves to the stimuli over and over again. And extinction comes about when we face an inadvertent spike, the one that the brain produces, and respond in a way that completely disengages from any type of ritualizing or any demonstration of its relevance.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's a really good point. And yeah, with the car crash one, or not a car crash, but the maybe I ran someone over. The compulsion usually would probably be driving back, checking the road. Was there someone there? Was it a pothole?
Yeah.
Et cetera. And instead of doing that, your response was amping it up almost. Like,
that's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
I did. In fact, yeah, it was a whole family.
I call it turning up the volume. You're going to give me level 6. I'm going to feed back to level 8. And interesting is EXRP for what is referred to as these neutral obsessions or somatics obsessions. Those include, blinking, swallowing, breathing. One patient recently from England, when I was talking to him, he drove me crazy because his neutral obsession was an awareness of his own nose. And, here I am talking to him. All of a sudden, the only thing I can see is my big Jewish nose, right? And I'm like, oh, my God. So he's talking about his nose and I'm seeing my nose. So we start having a great laugh over the unavoidable awareness of our noses. But that can also include the most common of the neutral obsessions is the idea of a song getting stuck in your head. The idea that the brain makes us aware of these awarenesses that we shouldn't be made aware of. We're not supposed to be aware of every one of our swallows or our blinks or our breaths, and we're certainly not supposed to be aware of our noses. But so with that, the EXRP that I most often use is having someone with their phone set a reminder that might go off 10 times a day. And the reminder would say, hey, are you aware of your breathing? No, we'll be aware of it now. To demonstrate the okayness that I can simultaneously have a conversation and have my attention be divided by the awareness of these stimuli. So a lot of people with these neutral obsessions tend to be a bit perfectionistic. They tend to be a bit ego-driven. They really resent anything that would distract them from being their kind of ultimate self. So the exposure there to say, yes, I'm now aware of my blinking. I'm going to be less focused. I'm going to be less verbally skilled. Okay, I'm going to make room for my diminished functioning.
Yeah, great explanation. Thank you. Is there anything else on the response or ritual prevention part before we move on?
One thing that's very, very important is the goal of EXRP is not to make the thoughts go away. It's funny because patients, they think that they're coming into therapy so that their brain no longer produces these associations. And that has a paradoxical effect. The more that you're waiting for the brain to stop generating these thoughts, the more likely it is that the brain's going to generate them because you're reacting to the brain's independent system with the idea that there's something wrong by the brain generating the thoughts in the first place. So very important to keep in mind that doing EXRP or ERP is not supposed to bring about association relief, you know, or even to some degree anxiety relief in the short run. And I say, patients say to me, Steve, do these thoughts ever kind of go away, and does the anxiety reduce? And the answer is yes, absolutely. But that happens when a person has made room for the brain to not stop these associations. So to say, hey, brain, I give you permission to generate these thoughts. I give you permission to generate this anxiety. And the more that one is authentically giving the brain permission to do that, the less likely the brain is going to be to deliver these associations in a way that is meaningful or that is emotionally charged. So that's really, really important because a number of my patients, when they get spiked, they'll take out an index card and they'll start writing on the index card as if they're using it as a bullet to create the absence of the association, the absence of the challenge. I'm like, no, the index card is to demonstrate the irrelevance of its presence, not making an effort to get rid of it. And that's really critical because trying to get rid of something that the brain produces spontaneously and independently of any of our will have a rebound effect that will sustain the brain's veracity in sending the signal in the first place.
Yeah. No, that's a really good point. I figure maybe I should title this episode Irrelevance.
Well, I think that's what ERP is really about.
Yeah, absolutely.
ERP is the technique that is designed to generate an irrelevant response to demonstrate the irrelevance to the brain rather than, you know, as you know, we talked about before, to generate the anxiety.
Mm. No, that's great. No, thank you for that. And kind of a slightly different question now, and I know you've answered this one before, but I'll ask it again. Just words of hope for those with OCD.
I find OCD a very, very treatable condition. And I think that the techniques and the science of our treatment is pretty well established. The way people go about the treatment is what makes it difficult. People, you know, live with such a sense of intolerance and resentment that our own brain is malfunctioning in this way. Mm. And that resentment can create a desperation for relief. And desperation is the biggest malfunctioning system in allowing ERP to have its effect. So by looking at and working with morale and working with the patient's expectations, when you just trust the brain doesn't want to be creating these signals, these negative signals in your life. The brain, people are like, oh, my brain's trying to torment me. My brain is such a horrible part of my life. And it's actually the opposite. The brain is doing nothing but acting as an overly zealous best friend, trying to protect you from these associations that are only relevant because the amygdala malfunctioned and paired up this distress signal with these very silly, irrelevant topics. So in terms of hope, absolutely, there's tremendous hope, but you have to really understand the nuances of the treatment and engage in the treatment in a very aggressive way, and don't do the therapy and then look behind you and say, hey, why are the challenges still here? I always tell patients to look within their past hour. In the past hour, have you lived your life in what I refer to as the unaltered path? Are you where you chose to be with or without these challenges in your life? If you're at your job, if you're with your family, regardless of how emotionally distracting the signals can be, focus on how your choices have brought you to the place of your own priority and your own agenda. And by doing that, the brain will join you in healing itself, because that's really what we're working with. The brain, the body, is an amazingly self-healing mechanism. And when we get anxious and we desperately try to escape that anxiety, it prevents the brain from engaging in that very, very amazing design of that self-healing. The brain only wants homeostasis. That means having things be at an equilibrium, having things be at the middle and the medium. And so by being anxious and desperate, it takes us away from the natural recovery process.
Yeah. Yeah, really good point. Cool. So is there anything else today or anything else you want to share that you wish you could have?
Let's see. So some people have what's referred to as a just right OCD. Mm. In just right OCD, they might place an object down and their brain says, no, you have to do it again in order to get this green light. And so people will engage in this redundant behavior of putting things down or placing objects in a way, or even having a certain thought before they can kind of move on, or even a number that creates this, as I say, a green light phenomena that the brain says, okay, you got it, now you can go forward. And so with that, you can work with occasionally a hierarchy, but often creating a willingness to, once again, it's almost like the neutral obsession, moving forward, making room for the awareness that things are off, that your life is off kilter, that there's a static in it, or pollution, as it were. Mm. Also, patients who have a form of spiking regarding psychosis. Patients will sometimes think that they might be seeing something. One of my patients kept seeing faces and shadows on the wall, and her brain says, oh, this is evidence that you're going crazy. Another patient had a fear that there was a bomb in her brain and that she needed to go get it x-rayed, or that even the thought that her brain was telling her there's a bomb in her brain meant that she was crazy and that she belonged in a psych ward. These types of OCD can be very, very misleading because they sound so crazy. They sound so off kilter to the standard types of OCD. But it's really important to be aware of their presence, and it's really important to have a patient, once again, engage in exposure therapy that brings on the willingness to generate these associations that suggest that things aren't right, I'm living in this off-kilter world, and yes, seeing that face in the shadow or creating a reminder that, hey, there's a bomb in my brain, that means I belong in a psych ward, that this is what, you know, kind of still promotes these principles of irrelevance and habituation.
Hmm.
I think that does it for me in that regard.
Nice. No, thank you. Good illustrations.
You're welcome.
Cool. Well, look, as always, thank you for coming on and for covering this important topic. I've no doubt it's helped some people.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
So there you have it. Thank you for listening to episode 200 and to any of the previous episodes. I appreciate it and you. Quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It's not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. Until we speak, take care.